And welcome to another exciting episode of the Click Nations Comic Book Chronicles. I think you're muted, Dave.
You had one
thing that mutes himself.
There we go. I'm your host, Tim D.O. Double G. And we have a full house here tonight. First up, we have PCN underscore dirt from the popculturenetwork.com.
Hey guys.
We also have Agent 70 here.
What's up, everybody?
Roddy Cat is in the house.
Yes, people over the internet, I'm a real boy.
And last but not least, we have a very special guest here joining us tonight. We have the Eisner Award-nominated writer of The Fifth Beatle, Vivek Tiwari.
Hey, guys.
Yay.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here, definitely.
Definitely love the interviews with the different creators when we get a chance to have them. So, yeah, we're looking forward to tonight. For those who aren't familiar with Vivek and the Fifth Beatle, Vivek, would you like to give a short introduction to everyone?
Sure. So The Fifth Beatle is a graphic novel, and we're also adapting it into a feature film as we speak. It's based on the life of Brian Epstein, who is the Beatles' manager. Brian is the gentleman who discovered the Beatles when they were an unknown, nondescript, unprofessional Liverpool band playing random basement clubs. They were not even the most popular band in Liverpool, and he guided them from that place of relative obscurity to the international superstardom that we know them by today. And he did all this while being gay and Jewish and from Liverpool. And in the 1960s, those were three significant obstacles. So it's an inspiring music story, an inspiring Beatles story, but it's also a very human story about someone who overcame a lot of struggles to chase his dreams. It's a real labor of love for me, and so I'm excited to be telling it in comics and looking forward to to the process of adapting it into a film.
My first question would be, how did the whole project come about? Like, I'm assuming you grew up a fan of the Beatles. What prompted you to want to sort of document Brian Epstein's story?
Yeah, so you're right. I did grow up a huge Beatles fan. My parents were huge Beatles fans, and I often joke that I was probably listening to the Beatles before I was born because my parents were playing them in the house while my mom was pregnant. So I certainly come from that place. But when I was at business school, I was dreaming about working in entertainment, dreaming about doing a lot of the things that I've been lucky enough to do in my life. And I tend to be a little academic, a little nerdy. And I thought, if I'm going to work in entertainment, I should study the lives of the great entertainment visionaries. And being a Beatles fan, I thought that the Beatles and their manager, Brian Epstein, were the team that kind of wrote and then rewrote the rules of the pop music business. So that's what led me to a study of Brian Epstein. And this was literally 21 years ago, and there was no Google, as there's no Google chat like we're on right now. There was no Wikipedia. There was no YouTube. There are none of these kind of online resources that we really take for granted today. And I was pretty stunned to find out that there was very little information available about Brian Epstein. So this began a little mystery, like I was trying to uncover why is it that, at the time I could find a book about John Lennon's astrologist, and I couldn't find a book about the guy who discovered and guided the band. And as I slowly uncovered this story, mostly through interviews, through contacting people who knew him and conducting one-on-one interviews, I did uncover this amazing Beatles story that I was looking for, a sort of business blueprint, if you will. But it was, as I mentioned briefly earlier, it was the human side of his story that really struck a deep chord for me. I wouldn't say that I've had the struggles in my life that Brian had, like not even close. But, being a young person of Indian origin, wanting to write comics and produce Broadway musicals, which is something I've done a lot of as well, I could really relate to that sense of being an outsider in your chosen field. And that's why the story means a lot to me. That's why I wanted to share it and tell it.
How did let's also make sure we bring up your collaborators on the project. The art was from Andrew Robinson and Kyle Baker, correct?
That's right, yep.
How did you come about to get that collaboration going with them?
Sure. So this is my first graphic novel. I'm very proud of it. But I grew up reading comics, and much the same way that I grew up loving the Beatles, I grew up loving comics. My parents, my dad in particular, were both comics fans. So I literally learned to read by reading comics. And so I was familiar with comic artists, and I knew that I wanted somebody who was going to be able to capture the period. You know, it's a period piece, obviously, and it's a Beatles-related piece, obviously. And there's a lot of people out there who are Beatles historians. I consider myself a minor historian myself. And, so I knew that we had to get the details right, the fine things. And I knew Andrew by his talent, by his work. And I knew that he would be able to nail it purely from a talent perspective. But it was when I sat down with him and we really hit it off as people, and I realized we were going to have a very collaborative relationship, and that he was a Beatles fan, but was very moved by the fact that this was the Brian Epstein story and not, you know, a backhanded way of telling the Beatles story, which we've heard a million times over. That was really important to me. So it was very clear from the beginning that Andrew was the perfect guy. And I was initially introduced to him through his agent at the time, a gentleman named Mark Irwin, who's a wonderful creator in his own right. He's an inker and a great guy and very well connected to artists. And when I initially started the Fifth Beatle Project, Mark came on board and helped me with some stuff in the very early days, sort of acted as an independent editor before we had a publisher. And he was the first person to suggest Andrew. And I jumped at the opportunity to meet Andrew, as I said, knowing him through his talent. But it really was kind of the creative collaboration that it was clear we were going to have that made me realize he was the right guy. And so Andrew's done most of the book, but there is a 7-page sequence towards the end of the book. It's an isolated sequence. It's called Chaos in the Philippines. And it is it's done in the style of the old Beatles cartoons from the 1960s, not the Yellow Submarine film, but the ones that aired on television. And so I knew that I wanted that sequence to be done by somebody who's primarily a cartoonist who could sort of pay homage to those cartoons. Right. And to me, Kyle Baker is one of our great living cartoonists.
Absolutely.
I've known Kyle for a long time. He's a New Yorker, and we've long wanted to do something together. And so I approached him, and he's a little bit older than me, and I figured he probably grew up with the Beatles, might have grown up with those cartoons. And sure enough, when I told him about it, he was super excited and loved the script and signed on. So I got very lucky. I got the two guys that I most wanted, and they're two guys at the top of their field.
Nice.
Yeah, very lucky. They're amazing.
Agent 70, did you have a question?
I did. Vivek, how do you think Andrew Robinson's art, how do you think his likeness has really contributed to the telling of the story? Because I found, that his likenesses to, the live subjects, the Beatles and Brian Epstein, to be remarkable and consistent throughout.
Yeah, I mean, this was a real challenge and something we spent a lot of time working on. We wanted the likenesses to be real enough that they would be likenesses. You're talking about the Beatles. They're internationally recognized pop culture icons. So we needed to get the likenesses close enough that they would look real, that people would believe that you're hearing the story about a developing John Lennon and a young Paul McCartney and how Ringo came into the band. You want to believe that you're getting the real deal here, because at its essence, this story is a biography. But we also wanted to be able to do something that was uniquely our own or uniquely Andrew's, to give credit where it is due. And there were a lot of stops and starts with that. There's a few things that Andrew tried that didn't quite work, or the likenesses were great, but they were too good and it didn't really look like comic art. It looked like photographs, or something where, the work was amazing, but it didn't look like the right likenesses. And so it was something we just spent a lot of time working on. And there's actually a collector's edition of the book, and there's a limited edition as well. The collector's edition, the limited is limited to 1,500 copies, and there are not that many left. It comes in a nice slipcase. But the collector's edition has the same bonus materials that the limited has. And it's got a bonus gallery that Andrew put together that includes a lot of his early sketches. And you could see the process as he was working through some of the likenesses and trying to nail that fine balance between having you sort of believe that you're looking at the Beatles, but also do something that's a personal artistic statement. And, I can't give Andrew enough credit. He really nailed it. He did a beautiful job.
Did it, when you were, of course, doing when you're doing research on this many individuals, you had to talk to, you know, family members, friends. What was that like? Did you ever run into issues where people were kind of hesitant maybe to talk to you in the beginning, but then you turned on the charm and got them to open up to you?
I mean, that's pretty much the story of the research. You know, as I said, I began this process 21 years ago when I was a student, and I wanted to learn more about Brian Epstein. I was kind of stunned to find how little information there was available about him. So, you know, in 1991, I resorted to the most cutting edge technology I could get my hands on, which was the phone book, you know, and I literally pulled I pulled the phone book off my shelf. I looked up the names and numbers of the people who knew Brian well, who lived in my general area, you know, people like Sid Bernstein, who was the concert promoter that brought the Beatles over to the United States for the first time. He was a New Yorker and he was Jewish, and he shared a lot of Brian's struggles as a Jew sort of hustling in the entertainment industry in the 1960s. Sounds a bit strange in modern terms, but Jewish people didn't work extensively in the entertainment industry in the 1960s, especially not in the United Kingdom, where it was run by folks like Sir Lew Grade and Sir Joseph Lockwood and, you know, Christian Knights of the British Empire. So I thought Sid was somebody who could really fill me in both on the business of the Beatles as well as Brian's personal life. And he was a New Yorker. I also looked up Nat Weiss, who was Brian's best friend and closest confidant and was the Beatles' U.S. attorney. Nat was gay and really shared that they were never lovers, but Nat introduced Brian to the gay nightlife in America, which was a little bit more open than it was in the U.K. I wouldn't say that it was easy for gays, but in America, at least it wasn't illegal. In the United Kingdom, it was a felony in the 1960s. So Nat could really, again, sort of illuminate elements of breaking the Beatles in the United States and the business of it all, but also illuminate elements of Brian's struggles as a gay man. So I literally just tracked these people down at their homes or at their offices, and I cold called them. And I said, I'm a student. I'm looking for inspiration, and the little bit I know about Brian Epstein has really moved me, and I'm looking to learn more. And will you talk to me? And I will be totally honest. I was so excited about reaching out to these people that I just literally forgot to be intimidated. I was just very confident, and they were amazing. You know, I think they all were probably a little wary at first and wanted to make sure I was who I said I was. But you know, when they realized very quickly that that's true, I wasn't some journalist looking for a scoop. I was a kid. I was a student. And I hope this still comes across now, but this is a labor of love for me. I'm coming from the heart, you know? And I think they saw that. And as soon as they did, they were willing to talk to me. Although I should say it did take years, and this is why the research really went on for 21 years, it took years for them to really open up to me about the personal stuff. You know, the business stories and that stuff flowed pretty easily because that's what I was looking for, and there's nothing salacious in there. You know, there's nothing scandalous, but the personal side of his life was hard for them to talk about because during his lifetime, as I said, it was a felony. So, you know, they didn't want to talk about their friend's personal life because it would have gotten him thrown in jail while he was alive. And certainly after he passed away and the laws were repealed, it's not like overnight it became socially acceptable. So these were difficult things for them to talk about. So that element did take a real years of building trust, I guess, is the best way of putting it.
I'm just curious about using a term like the fifth Beatle, because there are so many people like Stuart Sutcliffe or Pete Best or George Martin or Jimmy Nicol or any of those people that could all be heirs to the title, could claim the title. Was there any particular, do you try to invalidate any of them in any way, or is it just because it was used with him, he went ahead and used it?
No, look, I mean, it's like, I certainly don't invalidate anyone else, but it's a statement. You know, I think Brian Epstein was the fifth Beatle. You know, there's a line in the book where he says, you know, you guys play your instruments, you focus on your instruments, and I will play the business as my instrument. And to me, that's very poetic, and that's why he is the fifth Beatle. It's the other element of the band. You know, for that band to have been successful, there were the four musicians, and there was the business. You know, the Beatles in 1961 were a totally nondescript, totally unprofessional group of Liverpool kids that were, you know, had reached a ceiling in Liverpool. They'd gone over to Hamburg. They were literally thrown out of Germany and had come back to Liverpool, you know, having hit a brick wall. And it was Brian Epstein that really lifted them out of that and helped to bring them to the rest of the world. So in my mind, you know, that's the fifth element of a successful piece of art, you know. So that's why I think he deserves the title. Paul McCartney also said as much. You know, something we plaster on the book and on all our marketing materials
right.
is the fact that Paul McCartney said, if anyone was the fifth Beatle, it was Brian. But if you go on to also listen to the rest of the quote, he goes on to say, you know, a lot of people attribute that title to George Martin. And while George Martin was certainly incredibly important to the Beatles' sound, you know, by the time the Beatles made it to George Martin, they were a well-honed entity. And Brian was there in the early days when nobody cared and when the band was rough and raw, and he really helped to hone them. So I think being there at the very, very beginning and sticking with the band through their career and really introducing them to the world, these are all the reasons that make him the fifth Beatle to me. And that's why I feel comfortable throwing down on it. And McCartney validated it, so that's pretty good too. But, you know, I mean, all the guys you mentioned are guys who did their part in Beatles history. You know, Jimmy Nicol filled in for Ringo at a very critical time when the band was breaking and they couldn't afford to cancel a tour. Stu Sutcliffe was an early member of the band that really added a certain degree of professionalism, especially to John Lennon. You know, Stuart was his best friend and was very serious, and he helped to really focus John. I mean, all the guys you mentioned, you know, are important in Beatles history, but to me, you know, I feel that there would have been no Beatles without Brian Epstein. The Beatles would have probably never gotten out of Liverpool and may have broken up very prematurely because they had hit a ceiling. So I think he deserves the title.
And speaking more about the fifth Beatle, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that you're in the process of developing it for a movie. How's that process going?
It's going amazing. It's going amazing. So we are indeed developing it for film. You know, when I have 10 seconds to talk about it, I will say it's being adapted into a film. Although the truth is, you know, when I have a little bit more time to talk about it like I do now, what I'll say is we are expanding it into a film. So I've written the screenplay myself. So obviously it has the same thrust as the graphic novel. But if you were to read the graphic novel and read the screenplay side by side, you'll see that there are a number of differences. There are entire sequences that are in the film that aren't in the book. There are entire sequences in the book that aren't in the film. And part of that is appreciating the medium. There are some things that work on the page that just don't work on screen. And vice versa. But also it's not wanting to rehash something. You know, it's wanting people who care about this topic and are fascinated about Brian and hopefully who've been inspired by the book, giving them something else, something new, adding to their experience or their understanding of who Brian was. You know, that's what we'd like to do in the film. You know, to give you a couple of examples, the Pete Best story. Pete Best was the band's original drummer before Ringo Starr, and it was one of Brian Epstein's first responsibilities as manager to fire Pete Best. And it's something that for a number of reasons we decided not to put in the graphic novel, in large part because I wanted the book to be thin. I wanted it to be the kind of book that you could read you could pick up at an airplane bookstore and read it before your flight landed, no matter where you were going. It would be a quick and fun read. So there were a certain number of things that we left out, and I get to tell the Pete Best story in the film. You know, that's one element, one story that we are really looking forward to delving deeply into in the film that we didn't really get to delve into in the book. So it's been great fun, that process of adaptation, and we're in active development. It's going really, really well. One of the most exciting pieces of news is that we have secured rights to Beatles music. We are literally the first and only biopic ever to have gotten Beatles music. And what this means is Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Yoko Ono, and Olivia Harrison all signed off on the project, which allowed us to do a deal with Sony ATV, who control the Lennon McCartney music publishing. So it's a huge honor. Paul McCartney in particular is a very big fan of the book. He actually sent us a note saying how much he loved the book and complimenting Andrew's artwork, which was obviously was a huge, huge day for me. You know, I've loved Paul McCartney since I was a kid. So to be getting a note that he liked something I did was pretty surreal.
That's pretty awesome.
It was awesome. I won't lie. It was amazing. It was one of those really surreal dream come true kind of days. What else can I tell you? My co-producer on the project is Bruce Cullen, who's amazing. He won the Academy Award for producing American Beauty. He also was nominated two other times for producing Milk and Silver Linings Playbook. He produced Big Fish for Tim Burton. And our director is Peyton Reed, who most recently achieved some notoriety by being announced as the director for Ant-Man, which starts shooting in a few weeks. So I'm very excited for Peyton for that. But prior to that, he directed Bring It On, the first Bring It On, Yes Man, The Breakup. He's a wonderful director, a huge music fan, huge comic fan. So we're excited about Peyton, and we're casting Brian literally right now. We're out to actors for Brian Epstein, and really excited.
Nice.
There's one sequence I really hope you keep in the movie that's in the book. It's the sequence where the Beatles are coming in to meet with Brian about signing off on their contract, and he says, "You're late." "No, I'm not. I'm John." I literally started cracking up reading this.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to use that.
Happy to hear that that's still in the film.
That's awesome. I got to use that at work at some point. That's what I got to do.
Thank you, brother.
You know, my boss will say, "You're late, David." "No, I'm not."
I love it. Very kind of you. Thank you, man.
And last but not least, we want to make sure we bring up some of your future comic book work you have coming up with Valiant Comics. And providing a story for their, I think they're calling it the anniversary issue of Harbinger number 25.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. It's Harbinger issue number 25. I'm a huge fan of the Harbinger series, and it's the first time that they've let any authors get their hands on the new Harbinger. Joshua Dysart, who's an amazing writer that I'm a huge admirer of, has been writing this series, and so it's quite an honor and a responsibility, I think, to be playing in Josh's sandbox. And it's awesome. It's an 8-page story. And for me, it was great fun to be doing something that was so different from The Fifth Beatle in a lot of ways. You know, The Fifth Beatle is a graphic novel, so it's a novel-length work. It's based on history, obviously. So there were the constraints of history, of facts. And there are a lot of Beatles historians, as I mentioned earlier, out there. So I wanted to make sure I got all that right. So to be able to do an 8-page, very contained story that was superhero work, and I love superheroes. I grew up reading superhero comics. I think superhero comics at their best are human stories where, you know, the powers and the fantasy and the all the craziness is really a mask for what at heart is a story that everybody can relate to. And so I've tried to tell a very human story, in Harbinger 25. And it's a story that is directly tied into the experience of losing my mom. I lost my mom to cancer when I was very young. And so the story gets into that. So even though it's an 8-pager, it's a very emotional, very personal story for me. So it's a great thrill to be doing it. And I will also say The Fifth Beatle, as I said, I've been researching it for 21 years, but working on the book for a decade. So it's also very exciting to be doing something where, you know, from when I started writing to when the fans will be able to see it will be just a handful of months as opposed to years. So there's a number of reasons why I'm terribly excited about the story. And it comes out in July. And as I said, Harbinger issue number 25. And I hope you guys like it. We're going to debut it shortly before San Diego Comic-Con, I believe.
Looking forward to it.
Indeed. Thanks.
Hope it leads to some more comic book work for you in the future. I know you'll be busy with the Fifth Beatle, but we can hope.
Definitely. No, I can't quite get into details yet, but I do have a few things in the works. I love comics, and I love writing in comics. And you'll be seeing a lot more from me in the industry. So it really is. I've used this phrase before, so I don't want to sound like I'm overusing it, but it's a dream come true. I mean, this whole experience is a dream come true. As cheesy as it is to say that, that's what it is.
Not at all. Not at all cheesy. That's a great story.
Thanks.
I guess before
I was about to say, there's another sequence I really hope you have in there, which is the creepy Ed Sullivan sequence.
Yeah, that's funny. It is in the script right now, and I'm glad you said that because it's something that we debate a lot about that sequence.
Because that is creepy as all get out.
Yeah, no, I suspect. I mean, I love that sequence, and I'm pretty sure we're gonna film it, and then in the editing room we'll see how it comes out, whether it's too creepy and doesn't work, or whether it's perfect. I suspect it's gonna be great. You know, if you've ever seen Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch movie, one of my favorite David Lynch films, there's this great conference room scene where they're casting the film and there's a whole little bit with an espresso cup, and it's just so weird and creepy, and the whole thing takes place in a conference room. And I always had that sequence in mind when I was writing it. So actually, when I was writing it for comics, I actually had a very creepy and surreal film sequence in mind. But whether that creepy sequence will go with the rest of the film is yet to be seen.
Sure,
but,
sure.
I hope so. That's one of a scene I really love too.
And before we let you go, of course, since we're a comic book,
I was about to say, we got to ask, what's his favorite Beatles song at this point, right? That's got to be part of every interview you do. What is your favorite Beatles song?
I'm sorry, I just lost you guys for a second. What were you asking?
Oh, I was asking, what is your favorite Beatles song? Because that's got to be part of every interview you do about this.
You know, it's part of why I love the Beatles is that their music changes so radically from album to album. You know, I think there's some great songs on Hard Day's Night, and there's great songs on Abbey Road. You know, and those great songs are so totally different. So whenever I get asked this question, like I can't really answer it. But what I will say is, I think the song that represents me the most is With a Little Help from My Friends. I don't want to bore you with my personal life. Thank you. But you know, I mentioned earlier, I lost my mom at a very young age to cancer. I lost my dad a few years before that. I lost my granddad, who I was really close with. I've just lost a lot of people to illnesses. And I've lived a very lucky life. I feel very blessed. I'm not sorry for myself. But the reason that I feel I'm so lucky and am doing so well is because I've gotten by with not a little, but a lot of help from my friends and my family. So I think that's the song that is closest to my heart. But you know, I also love Day in the Life, which is sort of the bookends of Sgt. Pepper's. I think Day in the Life is a masterpiece song. You know, Brian Epstein, he very famously said the Beatles are going to be bigger than Elvis, which was crazy to imagine in the early 1960s. You know, you couldn't, it was unfathomable that anybody could be bigger than Elvis. So that's kind of what he's famous for. But he used to also say the Beatles are going to elevate pop music into an art form. And people didn't even know what that meant, you know. And I think A Day in the Life is like, that's what he meant, you know. Yeah. So I think A Day in the Life is a song that I think is also amazing. But, you know, when I think of like my desert island disc, like if I could only take one Beatles record with me to a desert island, it would probably be Abbey Road, you know, which doesn't have either of those songs on it.
Right.
So, you know, this is a really tough, it's a tough question to answer.
What were some of your comic book influences growing up?
Oh man, I really do. They're pretty varied. You know, when I was a kid, I read a lot of my parents' comics, and my parents read Archie. Certainly, I think everybody of our parents' age at some point went through a bit of an Archie phase. I also grew up reading. My parents grew up in British Guyana, so they called it Tintin, but we know it in America as Tintin. But so I grew up reading Tintin. And then as I got a little bit older, I really was a Marvel kid and a Chris Claremont kid. I mean, the Chris Claremont Marvel run changed my life. You know, like, yeah, he's amazing. Those books were amazing. You know, then I there was a period of time where I got to college where I stopped reading comics. I think a lot of people my age went through that little period. And then the writers that brought me back were people like Frank Miller and Neil Gaiman and Warren Ellis and, you know, those guys, Alan Moore. You know, those books, The Dark Knight, Ronin, the Sandman series, those books, again, they brought me back to comics. I think The Sandman is as great a piece of literature as exists in the history of literature. And I like, you know, I mean, to me, I like Ronin a little bit more than I like Dark Knight. And, you know, I love Watchmen, but I don't think it's Alan's best work. You know, I also love a lot of obscure stuff. And I also have to give a shout out to Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird. I mean, the early Mirage run of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to me was genius. And that was also something I was a huge fan of. And I really do mean the first 15, 16 issues of the Mirage books before they were a children's phenomenon. I think those books were incredible. So those would be the ones that I would single out.
Nice.
You read anything now?
Oh, I'm reading all the time. I just finished reading Trees, the new Warren Ellis book. I mentioned Warren Ellis. He's become a friend. You know, one of the amazing things about working in comics is you get to meet a lot of your heroes. So I've become – Warren's now a friend of mine, and I think Trees is amazing. I've been reading Sex Criminals. I read Saga. I've been reading the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on IDW. I love what Dark Horse did with the Star Wars books. I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I'm a little nervous, to be honest, that they're losing the Star Wars license because I think they did an incredible run with it. I would say those are probably the things that I'm most excited about these days. And I read Harbinger, I mentioned, obviously, earlier. I also like Exo Manowar, another one of the Valiant titles, and Rye. I'm a huge fan of Rye. It's just on issue 2, but I love that book as well.
Cool. Well, we want to thank you for taking the time out to join us tonight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's been a joy.
Yeah, it's going to come back again with your next project.
Before we let you go.
What's that?
So you got to come back again with your next project.
Oh, man, I'd love to. I'd love to. And I really do think there's going to be some big announcements, hopefully coming fairly fast and furious for the Fifth Beatle. So, if you see something that's going on that you'd like to talk about, I'd love to come back on the show. And if I can make a quick plug for people who are interested in learning more, we're at fifthbeatle.com. We're very active on Facebook. We are at Fifth Beatle on Twitter. And I really do encourage you to follow us because really I think in the next few months there's going to be casting news. There's going to be scheduling news. So there's going to be some pretty exciting stuff going on in that world. And certainly I'm at Vivek J. Tiwari on Twitter. And you can hear more about my Valiant work there. And I'm going to be at all the Comic Cons for the rest of the summer too. So please keep an eye out for me and for Andrew Robinson at all, also who's going to be at Heroes this weekend. And if you ever want to track us down, also on our website there's an appearance page. And between Andrew and I, we're literally all over the country talking about Fifth Beatle this year. So I'm sure I talked enough, but if you want to hear more, please look us up. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So
hope to see you at New York Comic Con in October.
Oh, New York Comic Con's a given. That's my hometown.
Yes.
I will be there. Totally, dude. In fact, we pretty much launched the Fifth Beatle at New York Comic Con in October last year. The book came out in November of last year. In October Comic Con, we did a whole panel. We let people see it for the first time. So New York Comic Con has a very special place in my heart.
Of course, yeah. That's the one New York Comic Con since they started that I missed. I got my tickets. I got my tickets for this October's already. So
it's going to be awesome. Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Looking forward to it. I'll catch you there.
Sounds good.
And all the information that Vivek just gave out, we have it on the post on the website, theclicknation.com, so people can go and bookmark that page and make sure to link up with Vivek through all the different social media accounts. Vivek, thanks again. We'll let you get going.
Thank you so much, guys.
For the day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be on.
All right.
Thank you, guys. See you again
soon. Thank
Bye.
You. Have a good night.
One.
Take care.
You too. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Let me make sure.
And that was pretty awesome.
He's still there. I'm going to go ahead and I hate to eject them.
That's right.
No, do not block. Cool. So once again, go to theclicknation.com where you can find all his contact information and, of course, to get comic book reviews and previous episodes of the Comic Book Chronicles. Follow the Facebook fan page, facebook.com/theclicknation. Follow the Twitter account at theclicknation. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/theclicknation. Circle the Google Plus page. Subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And if you have any feedback you want to have sent to have read on a future show, send that on over to theclicknation@gmail.com. And we're going to remind everyone that we record live every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And make sure to use the hashtag Comic Book Chronicles. You done, Dirt?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. You tell me.
Yes, I'm done. So now we're going to get into some news.
Hey, well, before you get into the news, can I show something real quick?
Nope. Yes.
We're fine. Whatever. So, as some of you guys know, Tim and I are going to be at HeroesCon this weekend. I am actually already in Charlotte for it. And I just wanted to show real quick the stuff that they gave out.
He cheated and went early.
No, didn't cheat. Registration was open. Thank you very much. But no, they... crap.
I was about to say, I've got goodies from Special Edition, but you can go first.
Oh, okay. Yeah, cool. Well, I mean, this is just like the free stuff. We hadn't really gotten into it because I did Instagram a picture of them setting up earlier when I went over there to register, but they were still kind of getting stuff together. But so here's what they give the people who did advanced registration. So you get, excuse me for a second. First of all, you get this, which, as I told Tim earlier, is a problem. It's the wristband that we got to wear all 3 days, which is a little paper thing. I had to tear it off because I wanted to take a shower. That's a whole other thing. Had to spend $5 for tape. It's a whole other thing.
See, I was like, to me, I figured they wouldn't just give you one wristband and expect you to keep it on all weekend.
Well, see, that was the thing. Like I said,
it's not a badge.
Well, I'm getting to that because actually we did get a badge. So yeah, we've got it. So here's the thing: on the back of the badge, they say that you've got to wear the wristband, and that the badge might be able to get you into some stuff, but it's not. That's not what they're using to authorize people to get into stuff. So okay. I'm not really understanding that. But like I said, badge. Got a program.
Yep. So who's on the cover?
I don't know who that is. Hero Kid. I guess it must be the mascot for the comic book shop as the Heroes. Heroes Are Hard to Find. Who's hosting this, his little shindig. And this little sticker thing, which almost, yeah, you know, this little sticker thing, which looks like a, I thought it was a coaster for a second before I was about to use it. And also, you get a choice of one or two prints. You get this one.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
By Raphael Albuquerque. And there was another one that from a guy named, I don't know him, Kieran Grant, I think, or Gant. My apologies if he ever hears this. And I don't think there's anything in the program about it. But that's pretty much what you get and of course the program has a bunch of, got lots of art by Scotty Young and some other people, and then it gives you floor plans and, you know, shows you where everybody's going to be. And whatnot. So, just figured I'd shoot it off real quick.
Cool. So yes, we will be getting together this weekend, and Comp Chronicles will be representing Charlotte, North Carolina.
Woo! Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. And Comp Chronicles was representing at the Special Edition NYC this past weekend.
Tell us about it.
Oh, it was lots of fun. It was the first ever edition of Special Edition NYC. It's an offshoot of New York Comic Con. It's run by the same promoters, Reed Pop. And this particular show is meant to focus more on comics because New York Comic Con has blown up so much that it's become a definite center for pop culture and for movies, definitely comparable to San Diego. So what Reed Pop wanted to do was to have a more comic-centric show. I got the cough button. So I just wanted to talk about what I saw.
Okay.
Here's a copy of the program. Right? Okay. Very simple. You know, black and white. Nothing too crazy. You could definitely tell that they were operating on a different budget than New York Comic Con. See, they even have like what used to pass as a Facebook before Facebook hit online. The guest list was actually pretty good for a what seemed like a medium to large size show. The crowd was good on Saturday, less so on Sunday. I think it's a tough weekend, it being Father's Day weekend, to schedule things. So I think Sunday was a little bit quieter than Saturday, but there was definitely a good crowd on Saturday. I saw lots of great guests. I can tell you that, honestly, guys, in all seriousness, Emanuela Lupacino is crazy hot in person. She's an artist.
Who is
and,
this?
Emanuela Lupacino. She's penciler. She's the penciler for Red Lanterns right now, and she did some Thor work, and I got some Thor work signed. And I was like, holy crap.
Yeah, I saw a picture of her over the weekend.
Yeah, I think she's supposed to be at Heroes 2, Heroes Con 2. So, you see this cute little blonde number. Oh, let me be sexist. But she was pretty cool. And, guys, you know who I ran into and met in person?
Stanley.
Mast and Joffo.
Ah, yes.
Former guests. They actually had meetings with Marvel all week. I wasn't able to get together with them to have drinks this week because we were all very busy. It's been a crazy week work-wise for me. But they tweeted, when I asked them how they were enjoying New York, they said they're very busy because they've got meetings and they're working on Infinite Comics, too, while they're here. And they're headed down to Heroes Con. So you'll see them. Yes. Tweet at them and you'll see them at Heroes Con this weekend. You know, it's almost like a circuit now because a lot of creators who are in New York for a special edition are headed down to a Heroes Con this weekend. Who else did I see? Oh, Ryan Stegman. You guys saw the tweets I sent out. Well, Ryan Stegman gave me a sketch. It did cost a little bit of scratch, but, I got a sketch from Ryan Stegman, and he knew of Comic Book Chronicle. Shout out to Ryan Stegman.
Thank you for lying, Ryan.
No, he recognized he recognized Tim's Twitter handle, and I know that Tim has tweeted at him, and they've had Twitter exchanges before, so he recognized it, and he literally said to me, "So you make sure you tell Tim, you show this to him." And I tweeted at him. He was on the tweet. He told me one sketch per podcast. So make sure that you hit him up. And
I was wondering what that was about.
Yes, and swing by his table at in Artist Alley and make sure that you check in and say, you just saw Agent_70 at Special Edition last week. So it was a good time. I can actually pull up the sketch now. I've got my sketchbook handy. You can see it.
Oh shoot.
I need a sketchbook.
Yeah, this was a 5-minute sketch. There you go.
Oh.
There you go. See?
And it cost $300.
No, it didn't cost $300. But definitely, it definitely cost something, but it was worth it. I saw, a lot of great creators. I can tell you a shout out to Brooklyn's own Damian Scott, who autographed my copy of How to Draw Hip Hop.
Nice.
He autographed it. He even threw up a tag in my sketchbook. One of my favorite things that I picked up was, even though it's DC, Carl Potts, has always been a Marvel guy to me. He did a book in the DC Comics Guide series of books recently called The DC Comics Guide to Creating Comics.
Oh.
So this is actually something that I would recommend to Tim because I know he wants to, learn about some of the nuts and bolts and creating a book from scratch. I would highly recommend this.
And who'd you get that from?
Carl Potts, the author.
Okay.
He actually autographed it to me He says, for My Secret Identity, fellow storyteller, and signs it Carl Potts.
Is that Carl with the K or C?
C.
Okay. I'm putting that on my list.
Yeah, Sal was going to make a joke, but that's actually pretty cool.
What is that?
No, I was just going to say, was it 500 pages of, right, say, writing a crisis every 5 years?
Oh, no. That's funny. And, you know, met a lot of cool people at the con, waiting on lines. There's some crazy lines at this con because there's some guests that I guess have been are somewhat hard to get to. Laura and Mike Allred made an appearance, and the lines for both of them, you know, were stretching for, you know, for hours. And I definitely, you know, I hung out and met them and spoke to them, but especially with Silver Surfer and just coming off of their run on FF, you know, they've got a lot of exposure now beyond just regular Madman. So, you know, there were huge lines for them. I just wanted to give a shout out to one of the indie comics that I picked up that I absolutely love. And it's kind of a weird title. It's called A Piggy's Tale, The Adventures of a Three-Legged Super Pup.
That is one of my daughter's favorite comics.
No kidding!
Yes.
So I got this autographed by the creators, Todd Emko. Shout out to Todd Emko and Ethan Young. This is one of the coolest things I picked up, you know, for a small price, and had them autograph it. I definitely recommend this. This is a great kid-friendly book. This is not just for kids. I can tell you that one of the coolest things that some retailers were asking me, where did you get that from, was they have this sticker that's pretty cool that you saw in just about everybody's hands, you know, for a small donation or fee. And you know, it's really just one of the coolest things that I picked up at the con. So, you know, I definitely had a good time. I give Reed Pop a lot of credit. They put on a good show. They had good guests. And the atmosphere was so much less taxing and draining than the regular New York Comic Con. You know, because in regular New York Comic Con, you know, you're basically, you know, shoulder to shoulder with people, even on Artist Alley, which, you know, which is definitely, you know, spacious, but with the regular crowds for New York Comic Con, you know, it does get crowded, but you know, this was very well done, very well organized. The staff was very friendly. You know, despite I saw something on Bleeding Cool about a cosplayer or who didn't have the best experience at the special edition. For the most part, I heard very good things about the staff at special edition. Trying to think what else. Oh. Very awesome. If you had made your way to Special Edition NYC, you were able to get your tickets to New York Comic Con before they went on sale. And if you saw some of the tweets and that I sent out and some of the posts that hit Facebook from Reed Pop and New York Comic Con, they are now sold out of their first wave of their first allocation of 4-day tickets and VIP tickets. And only and for the New York listeners who have access to some of the retail outlets that are going to have tickets, they're going to be very limited supply of 4-day tickets. I myself bought a three-day pass, and you know, it's for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I will be at this year's New York Comic Con faux show.
Yeah, I think they saw a tweet where they were going to us when I guess tomorrow, whenever the tickets are going to go on sale, or right, whatever the rest of the tickets go on sale.
Right. So the funniest part about the 4-day passes and the VIPs, they were sold out within half an hour. Not even. It's getting kind of scary.
Okay.
You know, it's far too reminiscent of trying to get San Diego tickets, and that's kind of bad.
Well, I suspect it's very much the East Coast equivalent of it, so it was probably bound to happen.
Right. So, you know, if anything, you know, this not that I wouldn't go, but it gives me more impetus, more reason to go to special edition, you know, and get my New York Comic Con tickets.
Plus, you can always say you went when it was cool.
Exactly.
So that was my experience. It was a great time.
Just to throw out real quick, you had Piggy's Tale number one. Number two just came out this week. So if you want to pick up number two, it just dropped yesterday.
Oh, you mean this one that I had before it came out yesterday?
You did not.
I had. It's the second sensational issue.
All right, then.
Yeah, that's great stuff.
The contest
great
going on between y'all.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That is funny.
Glad to hear that you had a good time, and make sure to tune in next week as Roddy Cat and I will recap Heroes Con.
Yes, and share some of the goodies that you pick up and some of the.
Well, unfortunately, it'll be just you because I won't be. It probably won't be on next week.
Oh,
because I'll be back at the schedule.
Well, glad you at least made it for the interview tonight. Yeah. That's definitely cool. All right, we'll quickly go through news. Let's see. When I say quickly, I mean kind of just blowing through this. Marvel talked about their upcoming Avengers X-Men event, Axis. Rat Queens is going to be made into a animated series. That's kind of cool from Image Comics. I'm enjoying that series, by the way. I'm going to skip the story about the Storify. So basically, memorize it. Kind of a Twitter conversation with the guy, Andy Schmidt, who runs the Comics Experience website, where you can sign up for classes and get taught how to make comics by actual comic book creators. He was tweeting out some, hashtag make comics tips about going to cons. Con etiquette is how it started. And he brought up how, con culture of after the con's over, everyone makes their way to the bars for drinks and whatnot. And I sent a tweet kind of saying, playing devil's advocate, saying how, for people that don't like to drink all the time, if they want to network, what should they do? And some other people took that conversation and had like a whole day long conversation according to the Storify link. But I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Some of that was probably go to the bars anyway, right?
What was that?
I said part of that was still going to the bars anyway, right?
Well, yeah, or
drink ginger ale.
Finding an editor and offering, a cup of coffee was something else he came back with.
In other words, stalk him.
Lunch. But not being creepy about it. It's a,
it's a fine line.
Yeah, it's a fine line. It's all about it goes back to network. And then it turned into question of con etiquette and people being creeps and getting drunk and how comic books, the industry is like a high school behavior of Brian Wood jumped into conversation I saw, for example, and he was saying how, early in his career, if you didn't go drinking out with the creative crew, you kind of were ostracized and you might, could lose jobs because of it. Basically, high school stuff. So, it's those type of things. So, I guess I should share. I did reshare the Storify link when I was notified of it, so I'll make sure to share it again for people to go and take a look at. So it was, it was cool seeing the actual creator jump into conversation too. This was like long after my original tweet, by the way. But I'd like to say I started the conversation.
There you go.
That's what we do at Comic Book Chronicles. Ultimate Spider-Man will be embracing the Spider-Verse next season with Ultimate Spider-Man Web Warriors, where Spider-Verse will be coming to the animated series on Disney XD. I said this might be enough to finally get me to watch again after the first season. I just want to see the animated version of Miles Morales in Spider-Man 2099.
Sure.
No one cares. I agree. So the September 2014 solicits came out. Make sure to go to your comic book website of choice to read all about the solicits from the different companies as Dirt holds something up.
And they all point back to one, so.
What is that, Dirt?
Ultimate FF is not in the September solicits. It is canceled as of number 6.
That was the next story. As Joshua Hale Fialkoff tweeted out this week, basically he's probably won poor sales on the book, and maybe his health, he said he was going through some health stuff. So he won't even be writing the final issue of it. So this can just lead to more speculation on the Fantastic Four books and Marvel and whatnot.
Yep.
Goodbye to the founding families.
There were, like, people are saying, you know, the Fantastic Four characters popping up in other books. You can see them, just not in their own books.
Yeah.
And I guess this has to bring up the question of how much longer can the Ultimate Universe survive? Because, you know, they relaunched all new, and so far the only thing that's been interesting or worth reading has been Miles Morales, the Ultimate Spider-Man.
Well, Ultimate FF, the story has been great, but the artwork is just terrible. I mean, if you can kind of turn off the part of your brain that's actually looking at the pictures and just focus on the story, it's actually really entertaining. But, yeah, the artwork is just terrible. Just terrible. Can't think of a better word. Just terrible.
Sound like Charles Barkley. It's terrible.
It's Charles Barkley.
Terrible.
Terrible.
Terrible. And it's kind of a shame because I guess they're you know, the Ultimate Universe is doing the same thing they've always done. It's taking sort of up-and-comers and letting them have the ultimate playground to tell their stories in to get their feet wet before joining the Marvel Universe proper. But, yeah, the art's on Ultimate FF and Ultimate – The all-new Ultimates, the story wasn't interesting, and the art wasn't that great either.
That's not a very good title.
Yeah, so that's kind of just throw that off to the side. And like I said, Miles Morales, Ultimate Spider-Man, that's the only thing worth reading right now. And, of course, we saw in the September solicits that the all-new X-Men team will be possibly traveling to the Ultimate Universe to meet Miles. So.
Right, and a bunch of books costing $4.99.
Yeah, that prompted a whole nother conversation last night.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Are they special edition books or just the mainline books are jumping to $4.99?
I think they've got extras in them, but might be a sign of things to come.
Are they going to have extras every month from now on to necessitate a $4.99 price point?
We shall see.
I'm going to go ahead and say probably not.
This is where Dave would play the dong.
Yeah. I was just too busy thinking of.
All right. Sad news for fans of. Actually, I didn't have this in here, but I saw IDW and it reminded me. So yeah, sad news for fans of the Ghostbusters series over at IDW. It is coming to an end. And for good news on the IDW side of things, they're relaunching G.I. Joe with Karen Travis and Steve Kurth.
Yay. And it doesn't sound like they're taking up where the last one ended.
Yeah. I read the first couple issues of the relaunch G.I. Joe, but it wasn't enough to keep my interest. But hopefully this new, all-new G.I. Joe will catch the reader's attention.
All-new G.I. Joe now.
All right, so that's the news. Let's get into some reviews. I see a lot of people read a lot of books this week, which is good. Let's see, where to start. I want to hear Dirt sell me on Winter World number 1.
Oh, really?
Yes.
It's not where I thought you were starting, so I got the wrong cover ready to go. Hold on, give me a second.
I always throw the curveball to you.
Damn! All right.
You should give me a heads up if you want me to start with them.
Like I had an X book ready to go. I thought for sure that's where you were going to start with the book. All right, Winter World. So this is a post-apocalyptic story set in the future where the world has been covered in ice and snow, and you're following a pair of survivors as they're trying to trek across the Caribbean to find North America. And, of course, it's all one big sheet of ice and snow that they're trying to get across. And it's funny, there's a foreword at the beginning of the book by Chuck Dixon. When he originally started Winter World, it was a limited series that was put out by an indie publisher in the early 80s, and they did a couple issues, and then they've decided to bring it back here for IDW. He said when he started working on it in the 70s, this was the Earth that was supposed to be coming, was that we were going to hit a great freeze and everything was going to be covered in snow and society was all going to fall, to the cold. And now it's all about the heat and the world's going to get hot and everyone's going to fall to, the rising temperatures. And so he said he's trying to keep, the politics of it completely out. He doesn't like politics of the weather, as he calls it. So his story, the fact that it's a world covered in ice and snow, he just thought was an interesting concept to go with. And what he really has accomplished is made, if you go back to like the early days of The Walking Dead or one of those type books where you're just dealing with this post-apocalyptic world and people trying to survive and they're really in a harsh environment and they're finding these relics of the world that got left behind. That's what Winter World is about, and it's really a compelling story. You take those same type of stories that you have when you're dealing with, whether it's zombies or nuclear fallout or any of those types of stories. It's that same type of thing, and it's really interesting and it's really good. You really learn to like these characters before the first issue is over. They're put in peril. It's a world that you recognize part of it, and of course part of it you don't because of everything that's happened. And so as I've become disillusioned with The Walking Dead, as it becomes less about zombies and more about just people arguing at each other all the time, this is jumping into that spot where people are trying to survive.
You show?
I'm so worried about season 6 of that TV show. this really does kind of fill that void. The artwork was really fantastic. Butch Geis, I guess is how you pronounce his name. He's been doing comics for, 20 years, whatever. It's just so well done, and it plays the characters so well, and it plays with the, the isolation when they're out. And it's, nothing, there's nothing on the horizon, it's just flat land because you're on the ocean and it froze over. So there's no trees, there's no buildings, it's nothing. It's just barren, desolate wasteland. And they're, just desperately trying to find land, trying to find other survivors and move along. And, what they find is not always what you want to find when you're out there alone and traveling and everything like that. So for me, it fills that void of that post-apocalyptic story, and it's so well done, and I really love this book. This is really, really good.
Nice pitch.
Yeah,
let me find the X book.
There's a bunch of them out this week,
and I actually didn't read that, haven't read that many of them yet. Okay, I'll start with actually the one X book I did read, Uncanny X-Men 22.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
So this...
I don't even think so. No, I think I gotta add it to my list. Go ahead.
This was the culmination of the arc where it's kind of been S.H.I.E.L.D. versus the X-Men. X-Men have been hunted by S.H.I.E.L.D. and they've been attacked by S.H.I.E.L.D. Sentinels who they suspect are being sent by S.H.I.E.L.D. It all ends in a battle at the Jean Grey school, and there's this helmeted figure who goes all the way back to Bendis' New Avengers, apparently, and apparently he's kind of been made up to be a big deal, and there's a big reveal, and it's kind of like, eh. it also doesn't help that it's Chris Bacalo's art who...
Right.
Who I like, but you can't tell who the hell that person is in the suit.
Yes. Yes. See, look.
Without the dialogue. The dialogue tells you who it is, but
exactly, and that's the worst part. It's a visual medium, and you don't think that's who they're talking about. I'm like, is this a swerve? Did they mean it to be another character? And then they told Baklo that's supposed to be X, and he was like, oh wait, I just drew Y. Hmm. You know, so they kind of screwed with the coloring a little bit. I'm like, wait, that's not him. There's no way that's him. So I was very frustrated with that because Chris Baklo is generally, to me, one of the better artists. You know, he definitely has a very stylistic take to things. But he's generally got a take on every character that you can recognize. And that was, I think, one of the biggest weaknesses of the story is that, A, you didn't care about who the big reveal character was. B, it didn't look like him. There was no clue that it was him. And it was just, you know, it was all completely out of left field, so I was left very nonplussed by the whole ending.
But it also felt like it kind of all quickly resolved in time for the original Sentai and that's like the theme for a lot of books that are on my list. But it wraps up in time for the, what they call it, next arc,
the Last Will and Testament.
Last Will and Testament of Charles Xavier. I couldn't remember the first part of that. Dazzler is rescued and looks to be switching sides.
Or just leaving S.H.I.E.L.D.
Well, switching sides.
All right.
But I'm looking forward to the Last Will and Testament of Charles Xavier because hopefully, as it's been teased, it's gonna rock the X-Men world and have effects on all books, X-Men books, yada, yada, yada.
Jean Grey gets everything.
She's his illegitimate love child. No. But Chris Anka will be doing the art for the first part of that, so that's kind of cool.
Don't forget to pick up the washer eyeballs at the Heroes Con. They'll have plenty.
If they're there, I shall get one or two.
Cannot see the unseen.
Okay, so that's my X book that I read this week.
Hey, speaking of that, let's get into Original Sin. Wait, yes.
Yes. That did come out this week.
Yeah,
yes, it did.
Losing track of everything. So, as was Tim... was alerted to the contents of this book by one Dork Geekus, and I ended up reading that. This was back up. This was a good read, one, but the reveal in the end wasn't as I was thinking it was something a little bit more than what it was. Because in fact, it kind of plays in. I kind of wish I brought this up last week. Because after the show last week, we brought actually a couple of questions about who was the person that was running the other team, and found out that the person we thought it was actually is. Because for some strange reason, not everybody else, because I hate saying that, but other people in other podcasts, or whatever, were saying that it was some different other person. As opposed to who it actually was, which is the person who's been all along.
Right.
That said, there were some interesting parts about this book. I love the kind of.
Oh.
What's that?
Oh, sorry. We just had thunder and lightning.
Oh. Thought I broke up or something.
No, sorry. I hope I don't drop out here, but yeah, I just. Because my camera's off. You can't see it, but yeah.
Understood. Yeah, but I like the fact that everybody was like kind of against each other, and I was trying to think of the movie that kind of played like, and the fact.
Yeah, I was going to say there were some great character moments in this book. You know, just in terms of the interaction, I did dig that. There were a lot of funny bits.
Right. I think Empress Geek had said that she would have loved to have seen a Rocket Raccoon and Punisher book, and I kind of would want to see that after seeing their interactions together, because that was pretty great. I mean, even though it wasn't much to it. So. But overall, I don't know. The one thing I wanted to really mention was, and I don't know, would it be a spoiler to say what happens at the end, even though
Spoiler alert.
Screw it. old Nick Fury comes in. So,
literally.
Yes, literally. Because so everybody gets together in this one spot that's out in space, and then Nick Fury just comes out of the shadow with a whole bunch of other LMDs, which the LMD that got the Nick Fury that got killed in the last book was an LMD, and apparently a highly sophisticated one, which was kind of curious because it was like, well, wait, you got telepaths and you got Wolverine, and none of them
picked up on it.
None of them picked up on it, so I thought that was kind of strange. And I think the what got brought up was, well, one, if Nick Fury Jr. was actual child, which yes, it is, because Nick Fury got around. Plus, I guess if we want to get into this like real quick, the reason why there is an old Nick Fury, it was actually brought up in books, or it should have been a
yes, old it was. Nick
Fury. As a matter of fact, it was like Mighty Avengers, I think it was.
Right. No, yeah, this is definitely a follow-up on a previous story.
Right. So, like, the only thing that I kind of wonder about me is, like, well, one, why is he using all the LMDs, and how, why is he in space? But I guess that's going to come out next issue. So,
my question was, overall,
it was pretty decent.
I didn't read it, so I'm just going off the Wikipedia stuff I had read originally when it came out. Mm. I thought that by the end of Battle Scars, which introduced Black Nick Fury, that Nick Fury Sr. had the Infinity Formula drained from his body, so he didn't have any more. So shouldn't he have already been aging anyway?
Well, see, that was the thing, because I thought he still had some of the Infinity Formula, but he gave it to Mockingbird when she almost died.
Correct. That was right. I think what ended up happening is whatever stores he had left were used up then.
Right. So it wasn't necessarily drained out, but
they would have. So since that, whenever he gave Mockingbird the Infinity Formula, till now he would have been deteriorating.
He should have been, yes.
Right, so, but just a lot slower.
Like Newsarama, for example, they had an article up debating whether or not every appearance we've seen of Nick Fury has been
an LMD.
And I was like,
yes.
I would say no.
Why?
Well, every appearance since, I guess he gave Mockingbird the rest of his Infinity Formula, right?
Well, let's say the more recent ones.
Yeah, okay, but they were making it sound like every appearance ever.
Listen, that's always a possibility. He is
that's
a
how I read it. Maybe I read it wrong.
I don't know. That would depend on how, like, when was the last of the serum used up within him and when he started aging? Like, I can't imagine it was just like, well, everything's gone and that's just it, I would imagine it would take some time to kind of get out of the system.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. So that's Original Sin. I said it's my favorite issue so far just because of all the interaction between all the investigators and finally had stuff happening.
Right. It was for me, it was a very frustrating issue because it just seemed like we've read four issues of this and we really haven't gone anywhere. But I enjoyed this issue. That's the funny thing.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like by this point, I thought we would have discovered something beyond just what we've discovered so far. But, we'll see how quickly we get through the rest of the story. Is it my turn to throw out a book?
Yes.
Okay. How about Silver Surfer number 3? So Dan Slott and Mike Allred and Laura Allred crafted this kind of wacky story to introduce a new, I guess, female character and I guess eventual romantic interest for the Silver Surfer, Dawn Greenwood. And, this story was actually, if you're looking for something with a couple of good, real kind of well-written laughs, read this book. And, it actually ends on a pretty well-written laugh. And I just, I was taken aback at how much fun I was having reading it. It's not my click of the week, but it's definitely up there because it was a lot of fun to read. There's not necessarily a. Actually, no, I have to take that back. What I was going to say is you don't have to be all that familiar with the Surfer character, but there's definitely some you definitely definitely requires some knowledge of the surfer and some of the character's history in order to really appreciate some of the elements in the story. But at the same time, it's well crafted. It's well put together. Some people are not fans of the all red style, but I think it definitely lends itself to the surfer and kind of a more psychedelic look. Some of these aliens and spacefaring scenes are, they're done fairly well in my opinion. But all red art isn't exactly everybody's cup of tea. So all that said, I enjoyed this book. I would recommend it. I think it's a neat little wrap up to the first three issues of the book, the first story arc, and the next issue conveniently guest stars the Guardians of the Galaxy, because they're going to be in the movies when the next issue comes out. So, surprise, surprise, surprise.
Does it go into any more about Dawn?
Somewhat. There's definitely some exploration of that. So if you are interested in that, and it's definitely well done, there's definitely some characterization and some backstory for her that's further described in this book. So if you're interested in it, pick it up.
I guess what I'm really wanting to know is the tie between her and the surfer.
Yes, it's revealed, and it's nothing. Maybe I'm downplaying it somewhat, but it's definitely revealed. I saw it when I read the panel that where they discussed it or explained it. I was kind of like, oh, okay, but it's nothing. It's nothing too deep or earth shattering.
Gotcha.
Okay. Let's see. Who else has a book up? Let's see.
I was about to say, I'll throw something out because I'm excited to talk about it.
Go for it.
Thor, God of Thunder, number 23. Anybody else read this?
I did.
Nope. This was all sorts of awesome this week. Holy cow. I read a review online and I found myself, nodding along and agreeing to it. This is definitely a heavy metal song. Like, that's just rocking out. This whole book is just, one big heavy metal song because it's just, completely, cover your ears, little kids, balls to the wall action.
It was fun.
It was a lot of fun. I just had a lot of fun reading this. The ending is actually pretty, it is well done. It's pretty touching too. But the art by Esat Ribic is awesome. Jason Aaron just has a great feel for Thor and the character and some of the underlying humanity in the character. This is definitely going to go down as one of the better runs, if not one of the best runs on Thor. In recent history, and I'm willing to definitely, throw it up there, near the top. And we all know how much esteem I hold the Simonson run in. So, we're definitely getting into, big trade paperback collection territory because that's how good this is.
Only negative I'll say is most the Original Sin, the book's ending to get ready for Original Sin, it kind of just ended abruptly. But you can't really fault a book that has King Thor and his god granddaughters in it.
Right. Oh, and that was, the granddaughters of Thor, did they have a quirky team name or something like that? I forget.
Goddesses of Thor or of Thunder or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they.
Something along those lines.
Exactly. The brief time that we've been that we've seen them since they've been introduced, they kind of stuck. I kind of like. I'm kind of curious to see where they go with these characters. They're pretty good. Like I said, the Ribic art is great. Seeing the future version of Galactus, duking it out with these Asgardian characters was a sight to behold. So, you know, that is my, if I didn't say it already, that is definitely my click of the week a little early.
Cool. I'll mention a book that's a contender for me. That would be Alex and Alex plus Ada number 7 from Image Comics.
Oh.
Yes. I keep calling this a simple story because it's basically sort of a future story of a society where androids are, you can buy an android and have it be your mate or your living mate or I guess whatever you want to use it for. And it's about a guy named Alex. His grandmother buys him an android named Ada. He kind of feels weird about it. And in some of the most recent issues, he's found some people that can grant light, sentient life to androids, even though it's against the law. So now there's all this, and he does it. So now Ada can sort of do what she wants. She doesn't have to obey Alex's commands. So there's also been some androids that have gone off the grid and kind of gone crazy and commit, you know, hurt people. And so now society is kind of wary of the androids, and the president has just initiated a law that outlaws sort of rigging of androids to give them sentient life. And supposedly they're going to hunt down all perpetrators. You will be found and caught and persecuted. So that's how the last issue ended.
We should have the right to root our androids if we want to.
Yeah.
Well, the thing, what I found interesting, you find this out in previous issues, so this is not a spoiler for this particular issue. But you do find out that the technology to remove dissensions from them doesn't exist. I mean, when they are created, they have that.
In them, right?
Yeah, it's already there. And what they do is they put a blocker on it. So when someone does buy an android and makes it, you know, like their personal manservant or whatever, they are technically enslaving them because that personality is there and that life is there. It's just the government forced them to put, you know, this blocker on it to keep it from taking over. So what he's actually doing is returning it back, granting it its freedom, you know, really. So there is this tale about, you know, slavery and freedom that's kind of buried within this story of, you know, this guy and this girl, you know, and their relationship coming together. And Tim's hand is way up in front of the camera.
What was that? I was scratching my side. Nice visual. So glad to see I'm not the only one that's been reading Alex and Ada. I keep saying Alex and Ada, Alex plus Ada.
Yeah, I just keep saying and. It's easier.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I really like this series a lot, and it gets deeper, it seems, with every issue than what you expect. Like, it starts out and it's just kind of like this fun little thing about this guy and this robot. But then as it goes along, you just kind of feel like there's really something deep going on here. There's something that's a lot of fun.
Indeed. I agree 100%. Plus the art, the panel layouts help with, like I said, the panel layouts are simple, kind of like the story is, but they're, it's also deep at the same time.
Well, and luckily the artwork really lends itself, because a lot comes through with things like facial features and the way they react to things and the way that when they talk to each other, there's a lot of the stuff where the frames will kind of linger on a person during a conversation, and you just kind of see the way that they're, you know, their face will kind of droop when they're kind of disappointed or sad, or they get worried about something. And it just kind of lends itself to being, as a visual medium, it's much more than just, well, here's a picture of two people talking, and now here's a picture of them walking out the door. You know, there's a lot going on with expression that gives it that extra depth and feeling that adds something to the story.
And sometimes it'll just be like the addition of the little, like, worried drip of sweat on the brow added to a panel from the previous panel. Just the little things.
Yeah. So it's I mean, if nobody, if you're not reading this right now, do yourself a favor and go pick it up.
Hmm. Okay.
Who's out? Who else is up? Going once, going twice. Okay. Thunderbolts 27. So I was worried with Charles Soule having to step away from Thunderbolts because I had been enjoying it so much. But I said, hey, I'll give the new, at least writing creative team of the Bins, Ben Blacker and Acker, I think their names are. And they also wrote the Thunderbolts annual, which I didn't read, but this issue was, it kept the same amount of fun and entertainment from Charles Soule's tenure. Plus, Carlos Barbieri's art is awesome. So he did the art for this, and he did previous issues, so the visuals was great, and the same amount of comedy and violence was still here. So I will still be reading Thunderbolts. This saga is, or this arc is, it's titled Punisher versus Thunderbolts because he tries to quit the team, but that doesn't necessarily go as planned.
You know, I wanted to jump on this title. I saw that Charles Soule was going to be jumping on, or was going to be leaving, and so I thought, well, I don't know if I want to jump on it now if he's going to be leaving, you know, in a couple issues, but if this ends up being just as good as before, or at least comparable, then I may go ahead and jump back a couple months and start reading at that point that I thought about it.
You really can read just from when he started onward, because I guess he's been on all year, so I guess it'd be like over 6+ issues, but I actually enjoy it when Ghost Rider comes on, so whenever his first issues of guest starring.
Okay.
To me. Because the art also gets good there, too. Wicked Ant, plus another one with another book with pluses in their name.
Yeah, I want to know about this book. What's up with it?
I almost didn't read it just because I didn't enjoy Young Avengers as much as other people online, namely the Tumblr community.
I'm about to say, damn, Tim, I'm right here. Shoes.
But I said, hey, it's a number one. I can give it a try. It wasn't that bad. That's not to say I'll probably be reading it every month or however often it comes out, just because I really need to trim the reading list. But for a first issue, I can see it being good enough for people to stick with it. I'm going to try to give the synopsis of it as far as I understand it. I believe it's about gods living on Earth, and some of them posing as rock stars. Like, what if gods were rock stars?
What if God was one of us?
That too.
Just a slob like one of us?
And it ends on a nice cliffhanger because there's this one girl, I forget her name. It's not the girl on the cover. It's she actually wears like men's suits, white suits, and has like blonde hair, blondie. Of course, the gods have powers. So anytime she snaps her fingers, she can kill someone, or at least that's the way we see it in the book. Like some out of nowhere, like there's an interview taking place in like a penthouse building with a lady interviewing all the performers, aka gods, I guess. And then there's like sharpshooters in the building across the street or wherever, shooting through the window, trying to assassinate them. She like jumps up and goes to the open window and she snaps both her fingers and the guy's heads blow up and explode far away. Somehow the police show up and arrest her because somehow they, you know, I'm not sure how the police would know that she snapped her fingers and their heads exploded unless the interviewee told the police or something. So she's on trial and she's like threatening the judge because like they're playing up the whole their gods thing. And then she's like, oh, what if I snap my fingers like this? And he's like, don't you do it. Don't you do it. And she snaps her fingers, and the judge's head explodes. And she's like, I didn't do that. She was like, I was just playing. I didn't really do that.
I was just playing.
So at least you do, and like, she's being taken, you know, carried out the courtroom and stuff. So it's like, who really killed the judge if she didn't do it? So it got fun near the end when people's heads were exploding to me. So nice tease to end. Ended on a nice cliffhanger.
And their heads was exploding.
I would just like to point out that I'm showing great restraint by not giving a Fist of the North Star joke. Thank you very much.
It will not be my click of the week, but not a bad issue.
All right. Anybody else got books? I just want to throw out a couple of rapid fire ones.
Let me go through Dirt's list. Make sure.
Yeah, here. Let me jump across the pond real quick. Batman Eternal 11. Anybody read this?
I did.
I'm two issues behind.
I didn't have a chance to put it on my list, but I did. I read it on my way home today. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I feel like I got punked reading this issue.
Okay. Yeah, I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. I mean, this story was.
Yep.
Unremarkable. But the artwork was just downright terrible. And I mean, this felt like a joke. This felt like one of those things that they would put out the Christmas party and be like, what if we actually put out a comic like this? But they actually put out a comic like this. I mean, the artwork was just bad. It was set in, I think it was Brazil. Some actor who's on a Brazilian soap opera. And so like there are these remarkably fat women in skinny little outfits, like chasing after him. And the Batman of Mexico or South America, whatever Argentina. His name is, Argentina. Yeah, he shows up with a couple other giant fat ladies on his arms. And he's there to get into the fight. And I just the more I read it, the more I was like, why am I even reading this? Like, it just got to the point where if they do this to me one more time, like, I'm done. Like, I don't like this enough that when they jump off and do some random side story with Batgirl and the artwork is downright terrible and it makes a joke of everything, it doesn't make me ever want to read it again.
Yeah, that was so, I'm inclined to agree. It was very tough to read because, you know, it's very different artistically and even story-wise from the stories that are set in Gotham City. And that was kind of jarring. When I started reading this, I was, you know, like you, taken aback by the style of the art and the way the story was written, because there's just a couple of even cameo appearances that just, you know, kind of threw me off. I'm like, this is a Batman Eternal story? You know, this is supposed to be it definitely felt a little bit more like a filler story, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, this felt like the issue you could totally skip, because there's really nothing about this felt important. No, there was no the grand discovery was that Stephanie Brown's dad hosted a terrible game show in the 70s or something. You know, it was just why do I care about this? And I just realized I don't.
I'm actually in full agreement with you on this one.
So hopefully the next issue makes up for it, and if it doesn't, I may be taking a sabbatical from Batman Eternal for a while.
It's been tough keeping up with these weekly books. You know, not so hard with Future's End, but, you know, it's been kind of hard.
Well, and the problem with all of these books is that when you do a weekly, you know, they have to have different artists because of the time constraints.
Right, the schedule.
I think I would appreciate it more if it was consistent within the characters of the particular story, but it's not. So you're getting a different looking Batgirl from issue to issue. You're getting a different looking Red Hood from issue to issue just because of the artistic license, as opposed to if every time it was the Batgirl story, it was one artist, and every time it was Red Hood, it's a different artist. It'd be a little jarring going from character to character, but at least it would feel consistent within the characters from issue to issue. Whereas these, it just makes it feel unfocused when it jumps from artist to artist. And there's this unfolding mystery that at this point there was only one real revelation about the mystery that happened in this story, and it was one of those things where they could have done that in one or two pages, and instead right. it was 12 pages into the story, and mm-hmm. the rest of the book was just this prolonged fight that you really didn't care about with characters that you probably never saw before.
Right. And even that one reveal that you're just referencing was just kind of, what did they do and why? Why on earth is that even important?
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Because, okay, so you've, well, I mean.
I know. We don't want to talk about it too much. But at the same time, you know, the whole point, you know, I guess the whole reason why I'm complaining about it is I don't understand what the point is. And I guess. You find out
that there's a hidden agenda and there's some subterfuge going on,
right.
but it doesn't seem important for any reason.
Right.
So.
Agreed.
So is there a thread in this book, or one that they kind of
there is, but.
James Gordon is framed for murder.
Exactly.
That's basically what it comes down. He's framed for a tragedy. That killed a ton of people in the Gotham subway.
Right.
And so they're trying to solve this mystery of who did it and why. And at the same time, Falcone has come back to reclaim his criminal empire in Gotham City that crumbled when Batman, you know, first came in and, you know, cleaned up the streets, whatever.
Right.
And so that's kind of the big arc of it. But this particular one was Batgirl going off to follow down a clue in another country of somebody who might be involved, but then you find out they're not really. And yeah, this just was a waste of time.
Mm.
It was a rough read. It was a rough read.
Is this the same artist that did the previous issue last week? Okay.
No,
If
this person did previous work, it felt like it was probably a fanzine with Mr. Natural in it.
Ouch!
I mean, it did not seem like the artwork of somebody published by one of the big two companies.
Hmm.
Can I say I'm not a fan of weekly books anymore? Just because having to read it, I don't have to read it every week. But you know, if I'm liking it, I have to put that time every week to read it.
Yeah, if the story's good, if it's a compelling, you know, you want to go back every week to catch up to it. You know, when they first started doing it with the Superman books in the early 90s, when they had four titles, and so every week one of those titles came out and the story went from week to week to week to week. I loved it when they did that because, you know, it was compelling stories that they were telling, but they're doing these as these kind of one-off stunt books that aren't necessarily tying into what's happening in the main books anyway. And so that's where it just, you know, it loses that that sense of purpose and meaning where it's, why is it important I'm reading this? It's not anything that's really important. Like, I don't know why I'm supposed to care about this.
Okay.
So. Anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you just said.
I will say there was a good Batman book this week. Batman and Robin 32, Batman and Ra's al Ghul. This was actually really, really good. So if you want a good Batman book, get this one instead. And this is following the story of Ra's al Ghul has stolen Talia and Damian's corpses from the graveyard outside of Wayne Manor, and he's trying to bring them back to life, and he's trying to find Lazarus. One of the Lazarus pits is supposed to be more pure than the others, so he can bring back bodies that have been dead a little bit longer, and he's been trying to find the right one, so Batman's been trying to track him down, and basically, Ra's al Ghul, if he is able to, you know, bring Talia and Damian back, they will be under his control. They will be part of the League of Assassins and be, you know, his puppets, basically. And what you find is that Batman, as much as he wants Damian to come back to life, the fight here is really about Damian's soul. If the body is resurrected, then the soul will be controlled by Ra's al Ghul. And so as much as he wants his son back, he's not willing to pay that price. You know, there's always that idea, well, I would do anything to have my child back. But he goes, you know, my child is worth more than being this guy's puppet. So instead of allowing him to come back to life, he's trying to stop him. And so there's this great kind of tension within him, as much as he cares for Damien and wants to save Damien. But then at the same time, you know, he's not willing to, you know, let this horrible fate become of him, you know, just so he can come back. And so they've done this story. It's been several issues now where they've been traveling around the world. And at first, you know, Bruce was trying to find a way to bring Damien back himself, but then as soon as Ra's al Ghul got involved, now he's trying to stop his son from coming back to life, and he's beginning to realize what a terrible idea that is. But at the end of this book, they make it clear that Damien is going to be coming back. There's going to be a, I think they're calling it Robin Rises, is going to be the special that comes out that sets off this storyline. And it's funny because I got done with this book, and I was reading the announcement about Robin Rises and everything, and I was thinking, you know, comic books have this ongoing problem where they kill characters and characters just pretty much stay dead until someone can think of a good story to bring them back. And for some reason, I'm not bothered by the idea of the return of Damien, bringing him back, because it feels like this is the natural continuation of the story. Whereas every time before, they do some big stunt where, you know, the Human Torch is going to die, or Captain America is going to die, or Bruce Wayne is going to die. And it's this big, like, oh, my gosh, they killed him. And they go on USA Today, and they're like, this is for real. And they're on Entertainment Tonight. It's like, death is death. And then 6 months later, someone goes, oh, I've got an idea of how to bring him back. And then they bring him back. Whereas this, when Robin died, they didn't tell anybody. You know, it's like the comic hit the stands, and, you know, Wednesday morning, USA Today, it's like, oh, my gosh, this is happening in a comic. You know, nobody knew that Robin was going to die. It was just, this is the story they set out to tell, and Robin had to die for it, and he's going to be resurrected for it, and that plays into Ra's al Ghul and everything that he stands for and everything his character is. So it just, it feels like this is the story they set out to tell, and they didn't make a big deal about the death. Because they're not going to make a big deal about the resurrection. This is the ongoing saga. So I just feel like this is actually the way that you should do it. You know, the character is going to come back, because they knew it when they told it. Like, that's the story that they're telling, is the death and resurrection, as opposed to just one of those big stunts where you get a chromium cover and a lenticular hologram on it, and the character's dead, and then he comes back, and it's a collector's issue. Buy it now. You know, we've got it at Midtown for $20, and then 6 months later, everyone's got a short box full of them, and they're worthless, you know. So I really like this story. If Zero Year is not your thing and you don't want the past, pick up the last couple issues of this and follow along with this storyline.
Good sell.
That's my spiel. Yeah.
All right, Age at 70. Let's get your quick reviews.
Quick hit reviews. Let's talk about New 52 Features End number 7. Yeah. Don't even remember all that much about it. Terry McGinnis is in the book. There's some Mr. Terrific stuff, and there's a couple reveals of what he's pushing around in the shopping cart. No, don't want to spoil too much, but you know, there is stuff developing, but it is getting harder and harder to keep up with the weekly reading schedule for these weekly books that are coming out from DC. So. It does kind of lend itself to a little bit of exhaustion, to be perfectly honest.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, it's another one of those where I'm trying to figure out why I particularly care.
Right. Agreed. I mean, I'm happy to read, you know, the ongoing adventures of Terry McGinnis in the current DC continuity. To be perfectly honest, that's sort of the draw for me. But, you know, I don't know if it's enough of one to kind of make this appointment reading, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's one of those where, okay, the two guys who do Firestorm that have to bond together, they're fighting. It's like, okay, right. I've heard that before.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, someone's going to create a teleporter and they're going to give it to the masses. Okay, like, why is that important? Mm-hmm. Why should I care? These people want to break into Mr. Terrific's headquarters and steal his technology.
Yeah, what's the big deal?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, why does this even matter? Right. You know, it's like, maybe, you know, this is issue 7, maybe in issue 25, they'll reveal why all that's important, but I'd kind of like to know now so I have some motivation to stick with it.
Exactly. Agreed. I will throw out, I know that you're a fan of Supergirl.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
So I don't want to spoil too much of what happens in this. I can tell you that just very quickly, I stopped to read this because I saw some of the art, the original art, at Emmanuel Lupacino's table at Special Edition NYC. And two things. One, I was actually very tempted to buy for the very first time a reasonably priced piece of original art because it actually had like a – it wasn't a splash page. But it definitely was good. It was actually from the Thor books. But I saw some of these Supergirl pages, and they were good. If you're not familiar with her art, she's definitely got some Jim Lee influence. But, it's not a complete mimicking of his style. There's definitely a good flow to it. The story in terms of Kara and being a Red Lantern, I'm still kind of torn as to, you know, how they're going to keep going with this, because it does seem a little, you know, a little bit like overkill, you know, giving a Kryptonian, you know.
It's not going to last. I mean,
we all know that.
The solicits for August and September show her not in the Red Lantern costume.
Exactly. So. But at the same time, it's just kind of like, all right, so how do we get to that point, you know?
Right.
So, this issue doesn't, you know, I'm not familiar with where the story has been, so it's kind of a weird jumping on point, but at the same time, you know, the art is good enough where you're watching the action flow from panel to panel and you're not bogged down in anything and you're trying to keep up with what's going on. So I give the creative team credit for, you know, keeping me engaged throughout the book and making sure that, you know, I'm following along as opposed to, you know, getting lost and kind of giving up as I'm trying to flip through. So that's a good thing. But otherwise, you know, I'm not 100% sure I would pick up I would actually recommend this as a you know, to someone who's picking it up for the first time. Avengers number 31 is a lot of Hickman mumbo jumbo, as we heard. Yep. You know, with regards to time travel, a lot of mumbo jumbo. But it does move the story along. You know, we see what's going on, and we see that, you know, it's just another step in the direction that Hickman is leading us. But, you know, it's just sort of like, all right, you know, it's kind of a different take on time travel. You know, it's not a different take on time travel as much as it is a different, you know, there's different byproducts or different side effects to some of this time travel that's going on. So, you know, at least that part is interesting. So I give Hickman credit for that. But otherwise, it seems like this is just another step in a long series of steps to get to where Hickman wants to go in the story.
Yeah, and they still don't say whether it's an actual future or, I mean, they kind of briefly mention it, but whether it's an actual future or, you know, some alternate timeline type of deal going on in there. Right. So we still kind of really don't know for certain.
Okay.
Right. So, do you have any other thoughts about Erotica?
About the one? I'm kind of curious about where the stuff, the Cap stuff. Actually, I'm kind of curious about.
Well, yeah, that was kind of cool. Because
that whole dialogue between him and the, I guess, future Cap, whatever that is.
Right. It was like an alternate. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that part was a little kind of crazy, but I'm kind of curious to where that comes up.
Right, and for any fans of, I was about to say, I'll throw out for any fans of the Dane Whitman Black Knight, he does appear in Avengers World number 8. I'm not 100% sure why I'm still reading it. But Dane Whitman does show up.
Okay. Clicks of the week time.
Yay! Well, I got mine in, so you guys go ahead.
Here's Thor, right?
Yes, Thor, God of Thunder, 23. Freaking awesome.
Well, I'll go ahead. Y'all know what time it is. Sex Criminals number 6.
Ah, nice.
And not just because it was a take and I wanted to do well, but it was actually a good read. I mean, it's always a good read, but it's back, and it's been a good read is a good read this time. It gets into a little more into, it's not, well, the whole arc is done and they're starting up something new, or this may be an in-between issue. I'm not really certain, but this is kind of going off on getting a little, you know, in a little personal with one of the characters while still maintaining, you know, some traction with the book.
Okay.
So read it.
Read it, people. I think I'm going to go with Thunderbolts 27.
Nice.
Really?
Yeah. Show some love to the new, all, well, the same Thunderbolts, but all new Thunderbolts. Yeah, it was just a fun book.
All right, I'm going to go with Winter World. You know, it's also one of those books that I talked about it earlier, and I really loved reading it, but it's also one of those things that after I put it down and went on to other stuff, I found myself kind of going back to it in my mind and thinking about that world and those characters and the stuff nice. That's going on there. So,
I skimmed this. The art is very good.
Yeah, it left an impression on me. And so I think that's the reason why it's going to win out, even though I kind of want to choose Alex and Ada.
That was my other, that's why I was going back and forth between two.
Yeah.
Oh, back up quickly. Harley Quinn number 7, because I totally forgot about that. I was kind of breezing through it. We finally find out who put the hit out on her, which that whole thing is kind of dumb once you see it. But but the book is pretty dumb in a pretty good way. So.
Oh, no. The book is pretty dumb in a good way. Can we quote you on that?
Yes, you can. I want that on the front of the cover. Get Palmiotti and
Amanda Connor.
Palmiotti and them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
So that's our clicks of the week. Make sure if you have your thoughts on what should be your picks of the week, make sure to use the hashtag Comic Book Chronicles. Make sure to follow us on our Twitter accounts. I'm at TimDOGG98. Roddy Cat is at Roddy Cat and at News Nerds Need. Agent 70 is at Agent_70. And Dirt is at PCN_Dirt. And go to his website, popculturenetwork.com. And once again, we want to thank our guest, Vivek Tiwari, for joining us tonight. Check out the Fifth Beetle. And
we'll be back. People.
At least I'll be back next week to give the breakdown on Heroes Con.
Yeah, shout out to all the creators that Tim and Roddy Cat are going to run into at Heroes Con and, you know, bring back some swag.
Indeed, we That's will. All right. So that's it for tonight's show. We'll be back next week. Same Comic Book Chronicles time, same Comic Book Chronicles channel. And we are the Comic Book Chronicles, and we are signing off.
Hey!